But the request was for a sermon on Where Are the Dead? And I thought that, yeah, that's, I can do that. And so I started jotting down a few things and so on. And it seemed like it had a life of its own. It just kept getting bigger and bigger, you know. And I thought, if I do this, forget the evening service, we'll still be here. So I've broken it up into several parts. I think maybe four. I don't know. And there's a lot of material that I may mention it today, but we'll look at some of these things in more detail later on. One of them is the account of the rich man and Lazarus. I'll mention that more than once today, but we're not going to look at all that and so on. But where are the dead? Think about that. You know, this is a question that's hardly new. I want you to go to Job chapter 14. Now, I'm one of these, and there's a lot, but I'm one of them that think that the book of Job was probably the first completely written book in the Bible. I think that it was written during the time of the patriarchs back in Genesis, because that's what Job was. And if it's that old, even if you, I don't care, if you, even if you put it in the time of Judges, wherever you put it, it's extremely old, the things that are in here, several thousand years old. And what you find in Job chapter 14 and verse 14, if a man dies, will he live again? All the days of my struggle, I will wait until my change comes. If a man dies, will he live again? Is Job here asking a question, where are the dead? It's similar to that, isn't it? Very similar. I think we can see that. So you see, it's not something that's relatively new. It goes back all the way. And again, I don't think that one lesson can do justice to all that needs to be said on this subject. I think that there are a lot of ideas that people have. I hear some of them sometime. Generally, when a loved one or something like that has passed, sometimes the things that are said aren't entirely correct. But you know, given the situation and emotional time and other things like that, I generally let it go. Maybe there can be something said later by the way of correction and other things like that. I'm not going to make any effort to be orthodox. In other words, I'm not interested in what all the world thinks. There's a whole lot of people in the world thinks that everybody's going to heaven. There's nobody going to hell, except for people that they don't like. That's about it. And so orthodoxy's out the window. I'm not interested. I'm going to try and practice diligence to avoid speculation. And I think that there has been speculation plenty on this particular subject alone. So we're going to be interested in doing a thorough investigation, and whatever the Bible says, then that will be our answer. And as I said about the rich man and Lazarus, they'll come later. If you ask me about it, probably the next time, the next lesson will be about the rich man and Lazarus. Now that will be for a couple of weeks, because Martha and I will be in Arkansas next Sunday. Anyway, now also, I realize that this kind of a lesson, I've learned this over the years, is one of those that has a lot, it can have high controversy attached to it. People expect to hear certain things and they don't hear them, or they hear something that maybe they've never heard before, and it causes a little bit of confusion in the thinking. And a lot of times when that happens, we stop listening. You know, we just stop because we're just focused on this, because it's not what we expected or it's different. So they're recorded. We're making a special effort to make sure that they're all recorded. If anybody would want the PowerPoint slides, be happy to give you a copy of those on paper. Or if anyone wants a copy of the outline, I'll give you that. I'll give you anything. Any or all of all those materials. All you got to do is ask. If something's said, like with the rich man Lazarus, come back. And you'll hear about that. If you have questions about it, we'll hear about it. You can do that then. We're going to just get to a certain point, and then we're going to stop. So we want to get started. And I think the very first place to stop is by looking at some terms and getting a clear picture of what these terms mean. And specifically, it's about terms as to things mentioned that are beyond death. And the first one of these is that there's a word that's found. It's found in newer translations, but interestingly, I have no idea why. You don't find it in the King James Version. And that particular word is the word Hades. And Mr. Strong says it is the place or state of the departed souls. Sometimes it's referred to as the grave. And in the King James Version, it's referred to as hell. Now, the departed souls, that would be, my understanding would be that, yeah, if you think, well, which one? Well, that would be all of them. Departed souls. When it says that, that's what it means. It does. The only exception would be with Jesus Christ on a certain part of that. Now, unhappily, this word has been translated as hell in the King James Version. Now, there's all the passages up there that have the word Hades translated as hell. I think, probably, and I got this one by memory, the Matthew chapter 16, verse 18. You know that one. You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of, King James Version has, hell shall not prevail against it. Well, actually, it's the word Hades there. Not the other words that are translated as hell and mean hell. It's Hades. And this would mean the grave. Now, you see, it means that death is not going to stop anything that Jesus has set in order or will establish or will keep going. Death won't do that. Death's not going to stop me. A lot of movements stopped at the death of a leader. But, you know, Christianity didn't stop, didn't even slow down. As a matter of fact, it accelerated after the death of the leader, Jesus Christ. Then he rose again, and he lives forever. Think about what that does in accelerating the movement. So the gates of hell, Hades, death, that's not going to happen. It's also over there in the passages that we had read. You see that at the end, Revelation chapter 20, verses 13 through 14. Now, it is translated one time, and it depends on what translation you have, as grave or death. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 55, O grave, where is thy sting? O death, O grave. That's the word there. It's the word that means Hades. And if you think, oh, does it correspond with grave? Yeah, same idea. That's where the dead are. You know, they're in the grave. The bodies are in the grave. And so this particular word, Hades, corresponds to the Old Testament concept of Sheol. Where in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word Sheol is used almost exclusively to mean either grave or death. I have death or grave, same thing. And one of the places where you find this, I think illustrated quite well, is in Acts chapter 2. Now, Acts chapter 2, and this is one of those places where you find the word Hades, and it's translated to King James as hell, but in the original language, it's Hades. You look over there, and in verse 27, Acts chapter 2, verse 27, it says, because you will not abandon my soul to Hades, nor allow your Holy One to undergo decay. That's New American Standard Bible. And in verse 31, it says the same thing. He was neither abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh suffer decay. There you go. This is something that's taken from Psalms 16 and verse 10, where the word over there is the word Sheol and grave. So you get an idea of how these terms were used. And there's a consistency in them, if you will, from the Old Testament to the New Testament. Then there's the word, the word in Psalms has Sheol, and then the others have Hades, and they correspond. Okay, now the word hell. This started, it's the word Gehenna, and it referred to a valley of Jerusalem, Valley of Hinnom. And it was just a terrible, disgusting place. All refuse was thrown in there, dead bodies of animals and people, common criminals. They were thrown in there. There were fires that were burned to burn up all this. And you can imagine the decay and the smell and all these fires. And the fires, it kept going because they kept throwing things in there. And so it would give the picture of just a terrible place. Well, now, of course, we know that hell would be way, way beyond that. But that's the picture of mind. It's a name for a place in the Bible of everlasting punishment. And I think really this idea of the word there, Gehenna, Valley of Hinnom and all, and translated then as hell, and used that way, is in order to present an abysmal and revolting place. When you get over here to Mark, those passages in Mark chapter 9, and it talks about this, and it says, it's a place where the worm never dies and the fire is not quenched. Well, that's right. Now, a worm there, that refers to the worms that feed on dead matter. So you can get the picture. And hell's going to be like that, worse, but like that. And the worms continue, and the fire continues because they've always got fuel to burn or something to eat. Hell's going to be eternal. There's always going to be something that's there. And there are a number of other places where the word hell is used. Now, let me just stop right here. Do you know, in the Bible, now you would think, oh, well, it's Revelation. No. Do you know in the Bible where you find the word hell used maybe more than any other? It's in the Gospels. Who do you think uses that word more than any other? Well, it's Jesus. I don't know what that does to these folks who think that Jesus never said anything out of the way or contrary or even unpleasant. Well, he's the one that brings that up about the worm that is, never dies and the fire isn't quenched. A number of other things. Yes, he did. And he did it for a point to present this as a terrible place that you would just do anything to avoid. But that's a term that's being used in the Bible, and we'll be using that as time goes on. Sometimes this word is combined with fire. It's hellfire. It's used three times. You can see them up there on the scriptures. And this is another thing. I just feel it necessary to interject this here. I'm going to straighten out everybody's thinking. And this may go counter to what you've heard all your life. It may go counter to what some sainted relative said or whatever it is. And maybe even a religious group that taught this or whatever that is and so on. But despite all the teaching that Satan is ruling on a throne in hell and just having a big time down there, I think likely that comes from old Catholicism. Somebody asked me, I remember one time I did this. Daniel was standing there. Somebody asked me, and I said, I think it comes from Dante's Inferno. That was a book that was written hundreds of years ago. I said, I think that's where Satan ruling on the throne comes from. And they just looked at me and walked off. Daniel looked at me and said, I don't think they know what Dante's Inferno is, Dad. I said, do you? Yeah. It could be. I don't know, but it could be. But anyway, Satan is not going to enjoy hell. Look at Revelation chapter 20, right before where Mike started reading verse 11, but look at verse 10. the devil. Now that'd be Satan, right? The devil, Satan, who deceived them, was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone. It wasn't that, well, he went over there and just took up his throne and just laughed at everybody that he got to go there. Common thought. No. Oh, he's going to be thrown into that. And that's where the beast and the false prophet are also, it says. And they will be, what is that word next there? Tormented. Day and night, forever and ever. All of them. Devil too. Ruling on the throne. I think we need to get these Looney Tune cartoons out of our mind about hell and the devil and all that kind of thing. And everything else that you've got like that. The Bible, as one fellow said, sure throws a whole lot of light on that subject, doesn't it? Yeah, it sure does. There's also one other word that's translated one time in the Scriptures as hell. If you go to 2 Peter chapter 2, 2 Peter chapter 2, and it's verse 4. Actually, it's in combination with other words here. We may see it as several words, but there's just one word. That's how they do things in the Greek language. It says here in verse 4, if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell, that's all one word, and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment. Now, it's all from one word, and the root word is the word that would correspond to hell. It's the word, let me get it up there. It's Tartarus. And it's to incarcerate in eternal torment, to cast down to hell. That's the verb form of it. It's only found right there. It's not found anyplace else. I don't think we should have any problem understanding. Yeah, it's talking about the hell. It comes from the word Gehenna as well. Another word we need to consider is heaven. Now, heaven can mean the sky. And, you know, like the heavens opened up. And although by extension it's referred to as heaven or the abode of God. Now, not every time, but most of the time that's how it's used. This is found, and there's discrepancies on this, so the English word, I'll just put it this way, it's found over 200 times, heaven. In the New Testament, far more than what hell is. Hell's found there. We've already seen that. But heaven's found by far more. I found one that said it was 240 times. And others had all different numbers, and I thought, over 200, and let it go with that. Hopefully we understand it's an impressive number. And sometimes it may mean sky. So, over 200. Now, I think, to get the concept of heaven and what it's all about, is to look at 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 4. I think that's sufficient as something that's representative of heaven. And I think really everything that it's all about. It says in verse 4, what Jesus has done, and God being behind Jesus to enable all this to come, the resurrection of Christ from the dead, and here, that he's gone to obtain an inheritance which is imperishable and undefiled and will not fade away. Now here's the last part. It's reserved in heaven for you. If you're a faithful Christian, there's a place reserved in heaven for you. I think that just says it all right there. That's not representative of everything about heaven. I don't know what there would be, you know, finding it in one passage. And I'm not going to come up with, you know, the vast number of things and go through all of those. I think that's enough to give us the idea. And so the dead are, here's some of the possibilities. Let's just say that. And those are words that are used, etc., etc. Now, here's something, though, that we need to consider. two parts to this. The first part is where the dead are not. Simple enough, isn't it? Now, the dead are not unconscious. There's a group of people that teach that when the person dies, that that's just it. You know, it's the old expression, you've heard it used, oh, those folks think that you're just like Rover, you're dead all over. That's it. And that where are the dead? Well, that's all of it with them. Anything else? No, that's it, period. And some modify that a little bit, and they believe that, well, the person is soul sleeping. And after they die, they have no consciousness. Well, they're unconscious the whole time, and so on. And that just won't work. Now, maybe there's some comfort in that for some folks. I don't know. I think there's comfort in the doctrine of purgatory, but I can't find it in the Bible. But they're not unconscious. I want you to look at Revelation chapter 6. In Revelation chapter 6, verses 9 and 10. In Revelation chapter 6, verse 9 and 10, the Lamb broke the fifth seal. There are seven seals altogether. Four had been opened. The seventh one is broken open. He says, I saw underneath the altar the souls of those who had been slain because of the word of God and because of the testimony which they had maintained. What did he see under there? Did he see bodies? Dead bodies? I don't watch that show, The Walking Dead, or anything. Nothing like this stuff, you know. Oh, he saw souls under there. All right. And they, verse 10, and they, that's these souls under the altar. They cried out with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord? They've been there a while, I guess. They're anticipating something. How long, O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood on those who dwell on the earth? How long is it going to be? Just avenging and others. You think that they're calling out about how long is it going to be till the judgment day? Well, that's what I think that they're crying out about. But I want us to notice here that these ones down here, they feel frustration. How long? And they appeal here for vindication. Let me just ask you something. Those souls under the altar, are they unconscious? I don't think so. And then when you go over to the account of the rich man and Lazarus, you know, you read all of it. You find out that the rich man, get this now, after death, they buried him. After death, he could see, recognize, feel, speak, plead, reason, desire, and remember. You do all those things when you're unconscious, right? No. No. The dead are not unconscious. And here's another thing. The dead are not just out of existence. You know, that's the doctrine of annihilation. You die, that's it. You know, just annihilation, that's all of it. Do you remember whenever Jesus was on what's called the Mount of Transfiguration? And let's see. Well, he took James and Peter and John up there with him, right? Uh-huh. And what did James and Peter and John see up there? Well, they saw Jesus, and lo, who appeared? Moses and Elijah. Well, were they annihilated? Where'd they come from? No, Moses and Elijah appeared on the Mount of Transfiguration. And you can go to other places. You know, you remember when the witch of Endor called up Samuel from the grave? I thought he was annihilated. No, not so. Here's another thing. Back to the case of the rich man and Lazarus, which we'll look at later. Probably 2 weeks from now. The rich man and Lazarus were not out of existence. Neither one of them. Some will say, oh, just the wicked are annihilated. Neither one of them were. No. No, they don't go out of existence. Now, here's another one, and here's where things might kind of... Now, listen carefully. Here's where things might go off the rails for a lot of folks. Where the dead are not, they're not in heaven or hell. Right now, as we stand here, right now, the dead are not in heaven or hell. The only exception would be with Jesus Christ. Now, I know we've heard this stuff about how somebody dies and, oh, they're just whisked to heaven in an instant, or they're cast into hell right at the time of death, right at the point of death. They're not in heaven or hell. And I know that's kind of a hard thing. But I think that's what the Scriptures say. Go to John chapter 5. In John chapter 5, verses 28 and 29. Do not marvel at this. John chapter 5, verses 28 and 29. Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming. That's Jesus saying this. In which all who are in the tombs will hear His voice and will come forth. Those who did the good deeds to the resurrection of life, and those who committed the evil deeds to a resurrection of judgment. So those folks who have been whisked away to heaven or whisked away to hell, when Jesus appears, they're going to come back again from heaven and hell. Really? That's what you'd have to say if that's what happened. And then you go over here to another portion of the Scriptures that we are familiar with. And I'm not going to read all of it. But it's the separation, the parting of the sheep and the goats in Matthew chapter 25. It starts in verse 31, goes down to verse 46. And you know how all of that goes and everything. And what happens here, it's like someone separating sheep from goats at the end of a day. But it's not about sheep and goats. It's about people. The goats represent those who have done evil and wicked things. And the sheep are those who have done righteous and good things. That's what it's all about. Because when you get over here to the end of it, and he talks about this, and he says, these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. When is that that happens? Is the parting of the sheep and goats at death? Is that when it happened? I'm going to tell you, I don't mean to sound flippant or sarcastic here or anything like that, but if the parting of the sheep and the goats happens at death, they missed us. Look at all the people that have died. And if it happened then, where's the parting? No. The judgment comes, and then there are those that go on to heaven or hell. This happens after the judgment. I don't know where it happens before. Again, the only exception would be with Jesus Christ. Now, let me just ask a question here. You all turn to Acts chapter 2. And I'll ask the question while you're turning there. Would you consider that the Bible treats David as a good man and a righteous man? I guess you'd have to say yes, wouldn't you? Isn't he described in the Old Testament and it, again in the New Testament as a man after God's own heart? Would that not qualify him as a righteous man? Well, I think it would. And let me ask you this. Is David walking around someplace over there in Israel? I'd say if he is, Geraldo Rivera would have found him by now. Make a good story, wouldn't it? No. David died. He was buried with the fathers, as they sometimes say. And it even goes on in Acts chapter 2, verse 29, that David both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. A man after God's own heart. Straight to heaven. Oh, I mean, that's a popular thought. Somebody like that? Yeah. But look at verse 34. it was not David who ascended into heaven. David's still waiting for the judgment. Unless it happened and it's all been missed. No. You know, that's part of it, and we ought to consider that. Now, a person can just argue all you want against the other things, but, you know, if you think that this part of this right here is wrong, then how do you square all the other passages to that? Now, I've got to admit, there's a lot of comfort, I think, when you think about going to heaven and things like that. I think that there's a whole lot of comfort in thinking, oh, well, I've got a departed friend, loved one, whatever the case might be. Oh, they died and they just went straight out. I understand that there's a lot of comfort in that. But there's a lot of comfort in a lot of doctrines that just aren't so. It even says in the Methodist discipline, used to for years, doesn't one copy that I've got over the house someplace, it says here's a doctrine that's full of comfort, that you're saved, you're justified by faith only. That would provide a lot of comfort. Of course it would. I think the whole doctrine part of Calvinism that talks about once saved, always saved, I think that provides a lot of comfort, but it's not so. And to think somebody's been whisked away, that provides a lot of comfort. Of course it does. I understand that. Is it true? Does it square with the Bible? I don't think it does. Which then leads to the next question then. So, where are the dead? Where are they? Now, here's one thing to consider. The spirit and the body, we understand this. The spirit and the body separate at death. The body without the spirit is dead. That's what happens. So, when someone dies, there's the body, there's the spirit. That's one of those things that has always just, you know, it mystifies, it mystery, and other things like this. And you know, when Paul begins to discuss this matter of the resurrection, final judgment, when he starts in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 51, he says, "Behold, I show you a mystery." And it is a mystery. And it has been for years. I think it remains that in the minds of some. Some are always wondering, well, I wonder where the dead are. Well, why don't you look at the Bible? I'm not looking over there. Well, then good luck. You know, just whatever. You know. But it is a mystery. Now, here's the thing, though. When you see this idea of mystery that's brought up in the New Testament, anywhere you find it, look real close in the context. And you're going to find out that mystery is no longer a mystery anymore, because the writer says, I'm declaring it to you. I'm showing it to you. I'm explaining it to you. And Paul says, I show you a mystery. And that means I'm explaining it to you now. And where we reach out and grab the third rail on this is when we want every single solitary detail, every question that we could ever come up with, and we expect, oh, they're in the Bible someplace. Well, good luck with that. I still remember what says way back in Deuteronomy chapter 29, verse 29. The secret things belong to God, but the things revealed belong to man. There's some, God's revealed to us plenty. Every detail? No. And I've met people, and they're frustrated by that. Frankly, I've always been satisfied, not just on this subject, any subject. I had a man one time say, oh yeah, you folks believe baptism in water and so on. And, you know, he says, well, why is it baptism in water? I was tempted to say, because buttermilk would be too hard to find that much of it, you know. Something like that. I don't know why. I just know that it is. I'm pretty well satisfied with that. So people can come up with anything and just almost demand to know. Well, there's just some things we don't know. And we're going to be satisfied with that kind of thing. I'm pretty sure, I don't have it here in the notes, but you go over to, I'll just mention it. In 1 John chapter 3, verse 2, it says, we don't know what we'll be like. When he appears, we won't know what we will be like. But we know that we'll be like him. I'm pretty well satisfied with that. Are you? I hope that you all are. But there's some folks that aren't. That's just not enough. Well, my hands are tied. I can't help you. And that's where speculation enters into the picture. We used to have a man one time. He went on and just practically waxed an elephant. He said, well, you know, when you die and you're about 83 years old and this and that and the other and your hair's all falling out, you know, and you have half your teeth and this and you're walking along, you know, and so on. And I actually walked like that for about 6 weeks. And so I'm not making fun. You know what I mean. And all these things, all the ailments and everything, and you die, and then when the resurrection comes, you won't be like that. Why, you'll be like you were when you were 32. I thought, I don't think I want that either. You know, I had one knee that was pretty well gone by that time. But that's speculation. You have a full head of hair, all your teeth, you know. I didn't ask him. I thought, would I even be good looking then? You know. That's speculation. And it's just, there's no point in it. Just be satisfied. When you die, the spirit and the body separate. I don't know how that happens. I got no idea. You know, scientists one time had some people, they signed the papers, they agreed to be part of an experiment. They were terminal. And so in their bed, which it was their deathbed, they rigged up a device in there to weigh the body because they wanted to know how much the spirit weighed. And they thought at death, when the spirit leaves the body, there'd be a change in the weight of the person. There was no change in the weight of the person from 1 second to the next. You know what their conclusion was? Oh, there is no spirit. I thought, what an exercise in futility. And I also thought stupidity. Anyway. Now concerning the body, we know this. There are several occasions in the Bible where it talks about a body and what happens with a body and what was done with a body. Now I'd like to focus on something that's at least the pleasant aspect of it. Look at Genesis chapter 50. In Genesis chapter 50, by this time, all of Israel, all of Jacob's descendants are living in Egypt. And at the beginning of chapter 50, you find out that Jacob has died. So there's a body. And then starting in verse 5, you see here, Joseph goes to Pharaoh, and it's 5 through 14. We're just going to read verse 5. My father made me swear, saying, behold, I am about to die. In my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and then I will return. You follow down through there, all the way down to verse 14, you find out the Pharaoh allowed Joseph to do that, and in verse 14, they all return. But there was a very large entourage, including family, that accompanied Joseph, the family, the body. They went over there and they buried it. They buried it where they buried Abraham's body, in a cave. And so the place that he talks about, a place where I've dug, he'd gone into the cave and cleared out an area where he would be buried. Later on, Joseph dies. He's embalmed. He's buried. They carry his coffin all through everything in the Old Testament. All that time, the 40 years, when they get into Canaan, one of the things they do right off the bat, they take the bones of Joseph over to that cave and they bury him. That's concerning the body. And I think that's essentially what we do. We bury a body. People come along and they'll say, well, what about this, that, and the other? Sometimes, you know, there's different things that happen to bodies and everything. Well, similarly. I understand there's disasters and one thing and another. It's just, It's amazing when all that happened with the Twin Towers, the amount of the temperature and the collapse of the building, there were a number of bodies. I don't have a better word for it. They were just vaporized. I mean, not a trace element, I'm sure, you know. But so many, and how would you do that? Just gone. And yes, there have been a number of people that have died at sea. How many people have died at sea in all this time? I have no idea. Known and unknown. I don't know. But it says in Revelation chapter 20, verse 13, Mike read this, the sea contains bodily remains, no matter how minute they might be or whatever it is. And the body, we are told, of Jesus went to the tomb of Joseph. It says that in Matthew chapter 27, verse 57 through 30, where it was buried. It was in there on one of these shelves over by the wall and so on. But it did not remain there, because when the women came over there, the angel said, come on in. You're seeking Jesus. Go in there and look. He's not here. He is risen. That's the body now. It's gone. But before that, they buried the body like they'd bury, you know, other bodies. And the body, now except in the case of Jesus, returns to the dust. I got Job chapter 34, verse 15 up there. I'm not going to read that one. But I am going to read and encourage you to take a look at Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 7. The end of Ecclesiastes. And it really, in chapter 12, it talks about advanced age. And one of the things in advanced age is at the end of advanced age, you die. Point on the man wants to die, then comes the judgment. Brethren, yeah. And in verse 7, the first part of this, it says that then the dust will return to the earth as it was. We came from the dust, we return to the dust. There's the passage. We'll read the rest of it there, that verse, in just a moment or two. But that's what happens to the body. No matter what happens. You know, if a body goes into the ground, back when they used to not embalm people, they didn't even put them in coffins. They put them in a shroud. Sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they threw them in the ground. That's it, you know. And sometimes they threw all number of people into a common grave. No embalming, no nothing. What happened? Well, they returned to the dust. They decompose. Now, let me just say this. This business up here of him being buried in a grave, bodily remains in the sea, trace elements, and turning back to the dust. If anybody ever wants to doubt the power of God, one of the greatest demonstrations of the power of God will occur at the resurrection, when God, with His power, can raise all of those, what is it, trillions, gazillions, going to raise them all. We've got all these scientists running around, and they're trying to create anything that resembles life in a test tube. And at the final judgment, at the trump of God, they'll all be raised. Whew. If that's not a demonstration of power and the magnitude of the power of God, I don't know what is. And if you believe that, I think, and believing in creation, that He created everything just out of nothing, I think you can do that too. That's the power of God. Well, regarding the Spirit returns to God right there in Ecclesiastes chapter 12. You're still there, verse 7. The Spirit will return to God who gave it. Now, that's to return the Spirit to God's good keeping. That's what that means. You remember that on the cross, Jesus said, Father, into your hands I commit or commend my spirit. I'm leaving this to your keeping. The body went to the grave. The Spirit went to God's keeping. And then later on, Jesus was raised to heaven. I don't think He went to heaven, come back. He went to heaven, He's going to come back again. We got too many comings and goings here for that kind of thing. And then there's the rich man's body. Now his body, it says in Luke chapter 16, verse 19 through 31, as plain as day, the rich man died and he was buried. But there was something over there in Hades. Now you tell me what that was. Now I know this, it wasn't his body. What else was it? Well, it was his spirit that was there in the Hadean realm. Now, to whet your appetite just a little bit, when we come back again 2 weeks, we'll study more about the Hadean realm and all that and everything. And it's all got a logic to it. It's all got a pattern to it. Everything. Can't do it all today, but this is enough. Please take your songbooks and turn to the song that's been selected. What we don't want to forget is that having all this information and then having a correct understanding does very little unless we have prepared for that time to come when death or the Lord's return takes place. And we just simply need to be prepared for that time. Now the scriptures tell us in John chapter 14 two times that Jesus has prepared a place for us. And he's given us the gospel to prepare us to dwell there. Have you obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ? If you do that, you have confidence to commit your spirit into the hands of God. To leave it all up to him at the judgment. And he'll take and do the right thing. If we could help you to obey the gospel today or make things right, get back on the right track, we'd be glad to do so. If you're subject, why don't you come? While together we stand and sing.